next case is State versus William Howell. Again, this is State versus William Howell. Mr. Catlett, you may approach.
Good morning. My name is Matt Catlett. I represent William Howell, the appellant in this case. This is a theft by unlawful taking case involving a motorcycle. I'm going to focus sort of an unusual little background here. Originally, there was two complaints filed in the county court. One was a felony for the motorcycle, and then there was a misdemeanor, two-count misdemeanor complaint filed in the county court the exact same day. I think the case numbers were like one digit apart from each other. Well, the case, we had a preliminary hearing in the county court on the felony charge, and the county court bounded over to the district court. Instantly, the state dismissed the two-count misdemeanor complaint, and then what they did is they added it to the information when they filed it in the district court. So, case law says that period of time that those misdemeanors were pending in the county court is chargeable, you know, under the 29-1207 six-month clock. And so once I was satisfied that there was no question about it, I moved for an absolute discharge as to counts 2 and 3 in the information, and that the state was reluctantly conceded that I was correct, and so those two counts were dismissed from the case. But that wasn't the end of it, as this court knows from the briefing. The state, what they tried to do is then get into evidence of these two bicycles. And I want to talk about that because these are really, there's three big issues here. Obviously, the first one is the Fourth Amendment issue, the suppression. The next is, of course, the statement by the CI that Howell took a motorcycle from one location and then to this location, put it in the garage, so the Fourth Amendment issue, the hearsay issue, and then of course this issue of the bicycles. There's really no question about it. Howell clearly refused to consent to a search of the garage. The evidence of the hearing established that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy in the garage. The state conceded it, and he refused to consent. I didn't address...
Didn't the leaseholders consent?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the leaseholders of the property consent?
They did sign written consents to search. Now, I have argued to the trial court at the suppression hearing that those consents were effectively coerced, because Howell had a reasonable expectation of privacy, he certainly has the standing to make an argument that consents were coerced from the other two.
Isn't it difficult for us, though, as the appellate court, the trial court made an explicit finding that the two leaseholders' testimony was not credible, and don't we have to... we have to give quite a bit of deference to credibility from...
There isn't any doubt about
the trial
it.
Court.
I, certainly that's true, and you weren't there to look at the whites of the eyes of the witnesses as they're testifying. I concede all that. However, this is a question of law, and the state and even Gratz conceded. They said no. They said no. I don't know what it is about police in response to the word no. But it's never good enough for some reason, Go get your warrant. But that's never good enough, It's
Officer Gratz did, right? He went to go get his warrant while he was doing that.
After statements about, charging them, with whatever we find, and battering ram this, and of course Vokasek and Meyer testified at the suppression. Well, Vokasek was a deposition, but about the, we want to leave to go to the grocery store, you can't leave. There isn't any question.
Again, those are statements the trial court found to be not credible, though. Is that, Isn't that correct? And the officers denied that they did not, or the officers testified that they, the parties were not disallowed to leave.
Yep, that's what Gratz testified to. And I concede that that's just an issue of credibility, and that's something for the trial judge to have evaluated. I just want the court to focus on the fact that this was, you know, Gratz said, well, 30 minutes, and then he later said, well, 45 minutes to an hour. I mean, this is a long time, 2-1 o'clock in the morning, you know, with the light shining in. They'd already said no, okay? And so I think it's, I just submit to this court that this was an inherently coercive environment, that they did sign consents. I mean, there isn't any doubt about that. But they also testified that they only did so because of threats of reprisals and the dog barking nonstop at 2 o'clock in the morning and the light shining in and officers in the back and in the front.
Mr. Catlett, with the time that we have left, I would like you to address the 404 issue.
Yeah.
And so let's move there, and I'd like to hear your argument in that regard.
Yeah, I think the state has operated under this theory that somehow this is all that they keep, you know, the prosecutor kept using the term, the phrase, the res gestae, you know, this it tells the story beginning to end. Well, the end was, I guess, the discovery of the motorcycle. I mean, that was what Howell was charged with. This didn't tend to make it more likely that he committed the offense, because, again, this was all just found at the same location. It didn't have anything to do with whether or not he had stolen the motorcycle. But as I understand the theory of res gestae, is that, you know, the state gets to present a coherent story, the beginning of the crime and until the end of the crime. Well, the crime charge was the unlawful taking of the motorcycle. The only possible reason to get into all of this other stuff about the bicycles was to show, was to, you know, try to get the jury to think, oh, this is, you know, this is a bad guy. He's guilty of the motorcycles because there's also, you know, stolen bicycles in there.
Well, Mr. Catlett, an element of theft by unlawful taking is the intent to permanently deprive. Is that, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
Okay. Does the evidence that the bicycles had been altered, well, first of all, the motorcycle was in pieces when they found it.
Yes.
And then you have rebuilt bicycles that were known to be stolen. Does that, is that relevant to the intent issue, the intent to permanently deprive? What's your view in that regard?
I mean, so that the jury hears, well, that the bicycles were also modified?
Well, let me try to explain myself a little better. It seems to me that the state's theory of the case was that your client was operating a chop shop.
That's what they said.
And so, not that they have to prove it's a chop shop, but that a chop shop would tend to go to that issue of the intent to permanently deprive. And so, that's my question, is that then do these other non-charged bicycles become relevant to show what the whoever's in control of that garage intent was with respect to the stolen property?
Well, I don't concede that at all. I mean, I guess there's no crime called operating a chop shop. I don't know exactly what that crime is. There's got to be something out there that what that is. But I mean, theft, you know, unlawful, you know, take movable property of another, you know, or exercise control over and the intent to deprive the owner. I think that this is all happens sort of simultaneously, and it's weird because it's not like prior acts evidence that shows, you know, opportunity. sincere motive, I think you're saying, well, does it go to this issue of if he had the intent to chop up the motorcycle? Again, he's not charged with chopping up the motorcycle. He's charged with taking it or exercising control over it. So I don't think the bicycles really had anything to do with whether or not he exercised control over the motorcycle. It just was specifically intended to try to get the jury to believe that, well, because he did these other... and there wasn't even any evidence. I mean, remember, at the trial, there was very little evidence that Howell... There was a lot of evidence at the suppression hearing about Howell and being there a lot and having a key and, you know, coming in and out of the residence and paying rent and all that stuff. But at the actual trial, there was hardly any evidence. What we get to the CI, he says. But I am out of time, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kemp. How much time did we go over? Please add that to the appellee's time. And Mr. Meyer.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Meyer. I'm an assistant attorney general here on behalf of the appellee, state of Nebraska. The state submits for the assignments of error without merit and asks this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. I'll start with the first assignment of error, the Fourth Amendment issue. And as Justice Harbour was hinting at, I will see the district court order, and the district court on page 5 of its order did in fact find, quote, the after-the-fact protestation of Bokasek and Maurer while considered ring hollow. And as a finding of fact of credibility and under the two-part standard of review that this court is familiar with in the Fourth Amendment cases, that is reviewed for clear error, and that was not clearly erroneous. The timing here, opposing counsel brought up the length of time that happened here. I think the court should keep in mind what is going on in this investigation. I think the evidence is that the police were on the scene for a total of maybe 2.5 hours. The first hour is spent directed towards the defendant. The defendant seems to be considering whether he's going to enter the garage, whether he's going to allow. I think he's adamant that he's not going to allow the police to enter the garage. The police are maybe bargaining with him a little bit to see if he will enter the garage while the police stand on the threshold. He ultimately objects to that, and then he asks if he's free to leave, and he doesn't leave the scene, and that's an hour into the encounter. Then police shift their focus to the Kotans, or the lessees, and they initially ask for consent. They're denying consent, and then the evidence is that the police return to the police vehicles on the street, and the lessees return to their home. The reasoning for the lessees, I think the evidence was that the lessees would not consent to a search even if they knew where the key was. They couldn't find the key of the garage. Even if they could find the key of the garage, they would not consent. So police return to their police vehicles. Officer Gratz starts making his way to the police station to write up a warrant. Officer Gratz testifies that he's gone for a total of 15 minutes. And then after Gratz leaves to go get a warrant, that is when the co-tenants, lessees, find the key and ultimately do consent. So, you know, it's not crystal clear, and it's not police badgering these lessees for an hour. It's a fluid situation where folks are saying, we don't have the key to this garage. Even if we had the key, we won't consent. Police then, you know, do go and start the steps to get a warrant. So, you know, the consent issue is reviewed on the totality of the circumstances, and for this court to find that the consent was not voluntarily given, it has to find that police overbore the will of these tenants, and the evidence here just falls way short of that standard.
So can you address the state's objection at trial? Not often defendants testify. In this case, he did. The defendant wanted to talk about his prior felony conviction, but the state objected and the court sustained it. Can you address that?
Yeah, that assignment of error number 5, I think that issue is controlled by the Castillo-Zamora case that I cite in my brief. That case holds that, so this is an instance of the defendant, I guess, wanting to impeach himself before the state can impeach himself. And I think Castillo-Zamora is analogous because, and it talks about the fact of a former conviction can be used to attack the credibility of a witness, but it cannot be used to attack the character of a witness. So, and that's where the the Supreme Court held that so that's why you can ask about a conviction, but you can't get into the details of the conviction. And here, so the defendant wants to preemptively impeach his own credibility. He's allowed to do that by asking about, have you been convicted of a felony or a conviction of a false information allegation. But he's not allowed to rehabilitate his character after he impeaches his credibility. And that's the difference. When he wants to ask, hey, was it a felony or was it a misdemeanor involving dishonesty, he's not allowed to do that because that goes into the character well past credibility, which is what the statute is intended to do.
You believe that applies regardless of whether it's just a witness as opposed to the defendant himself?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the intent of the statute does not change based on if it's a witness or the defendant himself. It's a character evidence statute, and it's meant to limit character evidence.
All right. If we could talk about the 404 issue as well.
Yes.
You argue that the court was correct in finding that the evidence was inextricably intertwined. It seems to me that an argument can be made anyhow that evidence could have been put on without any reference to the bicycles. The bicycles were not a predicate event to get to the to get to the evidence regarding the motorcycle. How, in your view, is it that these items are inextricably intertwined?
Well, Your Honor, because as you brought up to opposing counsel, the state's theory was that the defendant was operating a chop shop. So he's not necessarily being charged and convicted because he took the motorcycle. He's being charged and convicted because he's exercising control over it. He's manipulating it. He's in that garage doing different things to it. I point out that the motorcycle is found in pieces. So if the prosecution only presented evidence as it related to the motorcycle that was found in pieces, the story would be incomplete. And inextricably intertwined allows the prosecution to present a complete story of the circumstances of the crime. And the circumstance of the crime here is that, and that's where I think you can look to the testimony of the bicycle owner, who testifies that his bicycle was manipulated after it was stolen. I think a motor may have been added. So that's the situation going on here, that items are being taken off certain pieces of property, they're being added to other pieces of property. So I think, given that the motorcycle is found in pieces, it's more important for the prosecution to be allowed to tell a complete story of the crime. All these stolen pieces of evidence, stolen pieces of property, were found at the same exact time. And
if the defendant had been the owner, the sole owner of the property, and therefore he would have been the only one that had access to the garage, I can see that. But given the factual situation here where there were other individuals who were actually the co-tenants and had access to that garage, does that complicate things in here?
No, I don't think so. I think that one chop shop and whether one person was involved or more than one person was involved, and the prosecution is allowed to present evidence of the scene of the crime. And so then it becomes a factual issue for the jury to determine who had access and who was operating this chop shop. And opposing counsel brought up that not much evidence was presented at trial to prove defendant's access. I would respectfully disagree that the defendant himself testified. The defendant himself stated that he had a key, that he had stayed at the residence in the days prior to this occurrence. And that evidence was established in the defendant's own testimony.
The appellant argues that the rules of evidence should have been applied in the 404 hearing. I'd like to hear your argument on that issue.
I think they were. I think the district court's order was in the alternative and inextricably intertwined, and then also 404 was satisfied.
Does that mean you're arguing that if it was inextricably intertwined, then the rules of evidence, or then we don't even get to the issue of whether the rules of evidence.
Yeah, I think that's the easier analysis here, is just to focus on the interstrictly intertwined and not even get to the 404.
If we get to the 404, though, then do we have to address that issue?
Yes, and one thing I mentioned, I think the notice and the court's finding was that basically all of the particular statutory reasons for 404 were allowed, which could be troublesome. You know, motive, intent, absence of mistake, identity, plan, all those, I think in my cursory review of the case law, that could be troublesome because seems to be the prosecution has to pick two or three. I don't. So I didn't really focus my analysis there because I think the inextricably intertwined analysis is pretty simple here.
So you're saying you think the state's in a bad spot under 404?
I think they could be. Well, you know, without doing a full analysis, I don't want to concede the issue, but I do recognize that it apparently was omitted for every statutory reason that 404 allows. And, so once I encountered that issue in reviewing the record, I didn't really go all the way down the road because I wanted to rely on the uncertainty of the
line. You wanted to rely on the stronger argument?
Correct. That's how I prefer to operate sometimes. And and unless there are any further questions, the state would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Meyer. You are excused. The case will be taken under advisement. Thank you, counsel, for appearing, and we will. You are excused for today.